Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the deadly and destructive myths which are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism and the media, with military and also economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring behind the headlines while predicting how these institutions will shape our world over the next 20 years. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His is the lone reliable voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion at any time over the next 2 hours, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. I was sent a picture over the weekend of what we could call the Broadway. And I'm not talking about the place in New York, but instead the Broadway of religion. You know, Yosha is quoted as saying that the path to death and destruction is broad, that it is popular, and many find it. But we had photos of the Pope in Rio de Janeiro on Copacabana Beach with a serpentine path, typically 200 to 300 individuals wide for many miles long, that could be seen in this pilgrimage walking to the Pope. Now, if there ever was a depiction of a Broadway, and particularly a serpentine depiction of a Broadway along that long beach, it was there. They're all drawn to the popularity and to the pomp and ceremony of the religion. They're all filled with an emotional zeal, not recognizing, not caring, that it isn't God that they are getting to know. It's their Pope. It's their religion. It's their religious leader. They don't have an interest in learning more about God. They don't know His name. They won't use His name. They won't call upon His name. Their interest is being close to one another in their religion because it makes them feel good, and of praising, of showing their devotion to their Pope. The President of the United States did his part to corrupt us over the weekend. He redefined the term deadbeat. You know, once upon a time, you were a deadbeat if you didn't pay your bills. The term is used often in relationship to a deadbeat father, a father who has not only divorced the mother of his children, but who does not pay child support, is called a deadbeat. So it's been a term used for years to speak particularly of men who are unwilling to pay their bills. Now the President of the United States, he has used it to describe the Republicans in Congress, calling them deadbeats because they're unwilling to raise the debt limit, the spending limits of the United States, without also talking about constraining the federal budget. So the idea of being responsible, of trying to spend only what you take in and not continuing to spend more than you have available, is the new definition of a deadbeat. You know, it is like calling fundamentalists radicals. It is like calling a republic a democracy. Somewhere along the way, when we use terms like Lord to describe God, when Lord is the antithesis of our Heavenly Father's nature, the people who listen to these religious or political leaders become dumbfounded, because language, and we try to be very precise in our use of language here, not that I articulate precisely, but we do try to choose words with some precision, because words are not only the only means to communicate and to convey important ideas and thoughts. We think in words. And so when you corrupt the meaning of words, as the President did, calling those who are trying to be financially responsible deadbeats, giving it the opposite connotation, then you corrupt one's thinking. This is a very bad trend. It was played out to a great extent in the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman trials, where Trayvon Martin was presented as this perfect little young boy who had his innocence stolen from him, this black child, simply for going to the store and buying some candy and iced tea. While George Zimmerman was presented as the ruthless racist that hunted down this child and murdered this unarmed child in cold blood, showing that racism was the culprit. We corrupted the terminology. We corrupted the facts. You know, you're always entitled to your own opinion, I guess, but your own facts, no, that's not the case. Almost nothing of Trayvon Martin's very troubled past was conveyed. People magazine showed this angelic picture of Trayvon Martin, called it an American tragedy. Now, the more recent pictures of Trayvon Martin is him flipping off people on a video that he posted on his website because he was training in the mixed martial arts. No one wanted to hear the and listen to the post that he put on his various personality tweets and his Facebook sites, which are way beyond the language that we can even convey on this program. Here, a despicable young man who was not out buying candy and iced tea because he had a sugar rush, and it wasn't even iced tea, it was a watermelon-based drink, was buying it for a rush, was buying it for the intoxication factor. And yet, here's George Zimmerman as probably as accepting, if you were to search to find amongst the person who among us would be the least racist based upon what he has done with his life, the poster child would be George Zimmerman. It's amazing what we do with our words and how we corrupt things to use titles inappropriately. We even talk about profiling as being a bad thing, when if you don't profile, if you are not prejudice in your thinking, if you do not use evidence and reason to come to conclusions, then you can't think, you can't be civil, you can't be moral. We have the African American community up in arms that they're being targeted by whites. In fact, there was a robbery that took place over the weekend where the robber said that he was doing it to honor Trayvon Martin committing the robbery. You know, when we take this approach, as the President of the United States did, and made it sound like whites were targeting blacks, when the evidence is 20, 30, 40, 50 times the other way around, that depends if it's murder, it's some 30 times more likely to violent crime, where it's 60 or 70 times more likely that an African American is going to target a Caucasian individual than it is the other way around. That we don't ever factor that in to the profiling. It's very much like 9/11. Muslims fly planes into our buildings shouting Allahu Akbar, and we inconvenience everyone, and we're told that we cannot profile Muslims. We've lost our mind as a society. Turning to Israel, you ought to know that there's a problem. When a precondition, the lone precondition for engaging in peace talks with the Palestinians is the release of hundreds of convicted terrorists from your prisons. Somewhere along the line, where you're told that you're going to engage in peace talks, and the prerequisite required to engage with this party is the release of hundreds of their convicted terrorists and murderers, You may say, no, this is a really bad idea. How is it that Kerry is so excited that he has brokered peace talks between the Muslims and the Israelis when the precondition was the release of terrorists from jail? I thought we were fighting a war with terrorists, and yet we're forcing Israel to free them. Convicted terrorists. Terrorists that have committed a crime and have been imprisoned for that crime. And now the President of the United States has sent his Secretary of State to free them. It is astounding what we do. Well, now that the upheaval in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, in Syria, in Iraq, and Turkey has led to the targeting of secular political leaders in Turkey, two of them now dead, to Libya becoming jihad central for all of Africa, the ultimate smorgasbord of weapons, to a military coup in Egypt, and now the gunning down of protesters by the military junta, to now the death toll in Syria having reached 100,000, with rapes doubling or tripling that number, with an onslaught of suicide bombings in Iraq, with the most recent killing 50 individuals, but each year thousands upon thousands upon thousands are murdered. And to the suppression of human rights now in Turkey, when is enough enough? When do we start labeling the Arab Spring as the Islamic Reformation? Why don't we call it what it really was, an Islamic Reformation? And when do we come to realize that it was a very destructive and extraordinarily deadly idea? I mentioned this, but it bears repeating. The Tunisian opposition leader, a leftist, a secularist, his name was Mohammed Bahmeh. Bahmeh was killed with the same gun. His fellow leftist secularist, Corky Belaid, was murdered with. A Salafist is the primary suspect. A Salafist is a fundamentalist. Gunman on a motorbike killed Brahmi. It's one of the most common attacks that we see by Boko Haram in Nigeria. We'll return in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. It's been a bad day, actually a bad month for transportation accidents. We had the San Francisco crash where the pilots had not been trained and had not practiced visual approaches, which is the most common thing one does when flying an airplane, and they couldn't execute a visual approach with the 10 miles of visibility and unrestricted skies. Then we had a ramp man improperly use his cart, destroy the front landing gear of an airplane, and it crashed in New York. We had in Canada scores of people dying, being just incinerated when a technician improperly set the brakes on a train carrying diesel fuel. In France, a train leaped off of its tracks, also related to human error. In Spain, we all know that the very high death toll as a result of an operator error in going around a turn two or three times faster than the equipment could maintain itself on the tracks. And then now there's the death toll related 38 dead in Italy of a bus where it went off the road off a cliff, and there were no signs of skid marks. Just the driver drove it off the cliff. You know, it's in a microcosm the problem we are all facing on a global scale. Now, let me explain the most recent, which is the issue in Italy on a bus returning pilgrims from a weekend visit to a Catholic shrine went off a bridge in southern Italy on Sunday, killing at least 38, including children. The bus carrying the pilgrims home from the visit to a Acheron shrine fell 100 feet off the bridge on a road just east of Naples. A friend who sent me the article says, I thought the CNN commentator's remark that they were investigating mechanical problems because of the apparent lack of skid marks before they went over the edge was analogous to the tragic effects of religion. This ill-fated group had just returned from the shrine to Padre Pio, a very popular destination in southern Italy during the summer months, especially among Catholics. Religion is a dead-end street. It's true. This was the only one where religion was specifically involved. But think of the global and grander scale of all of these transportation accidents where either the operator or a mechanic failed. A technician or the operator having failed. We are living in a time when our politicians are not only incapable of doing the job, they're actually malevolent. You know, the NSA's crime that was perpetrated, has been perpetrated against Americans with the government spying on Americans as if Americans themselves are the enemy, and then fighting to maintain those programs when there isn't a single case of them producing anything worthwhile, and when they're wholly and completely in discord with the U.S. Constitution, making all of the sponsors of such program on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, as well as the administration, guilty of breaching their oath of office. We live in a time where there are means, because of our technology, where operator failure at the government level, at the military level, is capable of killing millions, if not billions. It's the first time we've ever been in a position where operator error can be so deadly. But it is operator error that has America on the just on the absolute ragged edge of chaos through our economic collapse, through everything that we have done that has been so egregiously destructive to this country. Operator error. The vote most recently to impose sanctions on any country that harbors one of the most courageous men alive today, Snowden, for having released the fact that Americans were being spied upon by their own government. We have operator error across the board. It's not just in our airplanes. It's not just in our trains. It's not just in our buses. But operator error at the religious level, at the political level, at the academia level, in the media. Operator error is going to bring us down. We have done this to ourselves. We have dumbed ourselves down and made ourselves immoral. Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. Yes, there's been a chronic series of operator errors in the San Francisco and New York plane crashes, the tragic crash of the train in Canada, where it literally incinerated much of a town. In France, when the train derailed, in Spain, when the operator is now considered having been careless for the way that he drove the train much too fast around a turn, and now in Italy, where a bus driver drives a bus off a bridge. And I think that we have, in large part, done this to ourselves, that our biggest concern on operator error ought to be at the national level across the world. Military leaders, media leaders, politicians, academicians. We have a lot of people now that know lots of things, but they understand very few things. And because of their lack of understanding, because they no longer have a moral compass, because they have been trained in political correctness to no longer execute good judgment, to no longer be discriminating, are doing things that are extraordinarily destructive and deadly. Operator error. Look at what we did when we invaded Iraq. The moment we invaded Iraq, I was shouting on every radio show that would listen that what we were doing was suicidal, that we were going to make a bad situation much worse. But operator error, we invaded anyway. Same thing with Iraq. You know, you look at Egypt, operator error. Our president encouraged Muslims. And so they rose up and they took over that country. But when we did that, it was obvious that we did not understand the consequence of our words. We didn't understand the consequence that we would unleash when we invaded Iraq, which is the Syrian civil war. It's the civil war now that is claiming so many lives in Iraq. It's the granting of Iraq to Iran. It's just a series of operator error. We have Glenn on the line calling in from Philadelphia. I understand, Glenn, that you have a comment on operator error.
Yes, good morning, Anna.
Good morning.
I was thinking about the operator error thing recently. I would have a tendency to segregate the, political things such as invasions and stuff from the things like the plane crashes and train crashes and stuff, although, you know, there are definitely similar principles involved. But the wars and stuff are ideological, of course.
But think of it this way. The reason most of those things happen is improper training. The people on operating those vehicles were improperly trained to operate them. And the systems and regulations that were in place were actually counterproductive across the board. And I think it's the same thing at the helm of our military and our politicians. They're improperly trained. Yeah.
Right, that's not my main point. I understand. There are certainly parallels, as I said.
Yes.
But overall, if I was thinking back, if you look back chronologically a few decades and think back to the granddaddy father of these things, which was the Exxon Valdez and Captain Hazelwood and Prince William Sound in Alaska, mm-hmm. is sort of like the beginning of the era of the manifestation of this with greater frequency and intensity. I see a number of sociological variables conspiring to produce this result, not the least of which is the acceptance of utilitarian ethics, which is, the end justifies the means, which means lying is okay. So you have Hazelwood drunk in his cabin while an underling is improperly driving the boat. And so the end justified means the deliberate implementation of utilitarian ethics, certainly strong all through the 20th century, certainly the second half of the 20th century, and the dumbing down of the populace, and I would even suggest the dependency upon automation. In my day, it was kids don't know their multiplication tables because they're carrying calculators on their belts. Nowadays, it's people don't understand that if they crash the plane, they can't hit the reset button because they're playing too many video games.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment, Glenn. I think you said something that is interesting. I am a big stickler for one of the reasons we're in such a mess is that we're no longer rational. We're no longer logical. We don't teach rhetoric and logic and logical decision making in school anymore. And the moment you cease to be rational and logical, you cease to be moral, you cease to be just, your existence is nullified. And you mentioned calculators versus multiplication tables. To a large extent, making a rational conclusion based upon the evidence, connecting things and coming to a conclusion, is based on probabilities, on considering, with this set of facts, what is the most likely cause and effect. And when we eliminate one of the mental processes for just evaluating probabilities and likelihoods, which is really understanding multiplication tables, being able to do division in your head and understanding the relationship between these things, we lose the mental capability of running probabilities. And so I think there's a great truth. I grew up in this transition from mathematical tables and using a slide rule, which still has the brain engaged in the process, because you're having to understand the relationship between the question and the answer with a slide rule. The magnitudes are so essential. So you have to have a general understanding of what the answer is going to be for the slide rule to be effective for it, because it's an estimating tool. But with the calculator, all you have to do is put in the data. You don't have to think about the data. And it gives you an exact answer relative to the data, but it's taken thought out of the process. And to a large degree, that's the same thing that's happened with political correctness, where we have taught generations now of individuals not to look at the evidence and to evaluate the evidence and to actually accept mutually exclusive things as all being possible.
Right. Yeah, when I was in 10th grade, we had to do our logarithms on slide rules. Now, I don't know if you know what they are.
Yes.
Nowadays, if I buy something for $1.82 and I give the cashier $2.07, they can't figure out that I want 3/4 back. You know, it's really horrific. And especially the automation thing, this idea that it doesn't really, you know, people don't grasp the physical implications of getting it wrong in the real material world. They're literally so used to rebooting things and hitting reset buttons and starting again. It doesn't work that way, and they don't get it.
It's one of the reasons. It's one of the reasons, Glenn, I'm so opposed to the use of drones, because drones are thought of by the operators as if they're playing a video game, they're sitting there at the console, they're flying the drone just as they would in a video game. It's a first person shooter game, but they're armed with missiles, and people are actually dying, and you can't get reboot.
To put the icing on that, I remember wondering back in the 80s and 90s if we were being conditioned by the video games for just such things. And here we have the full fruition of it, you know. They've got robots for surgeons in the field and stuff like that, you know. But you talk about logic. How many people have any clue what the terms law of identity, law of non-contradiction, and law of the excluded middle mean? You know, who studies formal language and logic?
Not too many. No one. I was with a school board member the other day, and I was talking about what my greatest concern is in education. And this woman has been reelected probably a dozen times now to a school board. Very, very nice lady. Very well-educated individual. And we were talking about the lack of rhetoric and of logical decision-making being taught in school, and the fact that there are very few debate clubs now at universities where debate and the rules of debate, where you would study all of the fallacies and be able to name them when your opponent commits a fallacy, that it's no longer taught, no longer even an option. And she said that the closest thing they have to it now in school is a requirement for the students to be able to ascertain the subject of an article. So if they read an article, they're then required to say what was the principal point of the article. But that's as far as they can go. They can identify that I know that this is what was said. But that doesn't get you to the next step, which is the step that we're talking about. Knowing is easy. Understanding is the hard part. And
not exactly, modus ponens versus modus tollens or anything like that.
Yes. So,
we live in a society where legislators are signing into law pieces of legislation the titles of which have nothing to do with the words between their pages.
When you look at the Patriot Act, you know, it was made to sound like a good thing. But the Patriot Act is the very act that brought on the secret court that has allowed our government to breach the U.S. Constitution, which is if there was a basis for patriotism, it should be the U.S. Constitution. What the act enabled the government to do was to ignore and even to contradict the U.S. Constitution. We call the monies that is given to those who are unemployed, unemployment benefits. Like there's a benefit to be unemployed. We say there is.
Most of the unemployed people I know have a better cable plan, beer, cigarettes, and time to watch the TV than I do.
Well, in the state of California, which is the largest welfare state in the country, the average welfare recipient gets more than someone who would work 40 hours a week at $20 an hour. So it is true. We have put ourselves in a horrible position because we have taken logical thought, logical decision making out of the matrix, and we've corrupted our terminology. If you were to ask Americans, are we engaged in a war against terrorism, and should we support the NSA spying on Americans because it can keep us safe from terrorists? Not recognizing that you can't declare war on a tactic, and that there's only one group of people who are responsible for terrorism today, and that is Muslims. And you don't need to spy on average Americans to thwart Islamic terrorism. And yet, most Americans are incapable of having that discussion. And even if you have that discussion and you point out the truth to them, within minutes of that time, they're back on using their pre-existing rhetoric, unable to process anything that was said. We'll be back with Shattering This after the commercial break. This time, your host, Jetta. I want to turn to a small story. It's a story that was sent to me by a gentleman I've known for a very long time, that we have exchanged emails many times. He's been a big help in my current editing of Questioning Paul. And sometimes it's the little things that tell you a lot. This story is one of those, and he sent it to me with that in mind, that it is a little story that reveals a great deal. Camel racing is a popular sport in Pakistan, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Bahrain, in Jordan, in Qatar, in the United Arab Emirates, in Oman, and in parts of Mongolia. Now, my guess is he left out a few names, but other than Mongolia, what you would be seeing there is that these are all Islamic countries. And, okay, so they have camels. They want to race the camels. No big deal, right? Well, professional camel racing, like horse racing, is an event for betting and tourist attraction. Camels can run at speeds of 65 kilometers per hour or 40 miles per hour in short sprints, but they can maintain a speed of 40 kilometers per hour or 25 miles per hour for an entire hour. So, what's the big deal? Well, listen. Children are the favorite jockeys because of their light weight. It has been reported that thousands of children, some as young as 2 years old, so we're not really talking, we're talking about toddlers here. And for the most part, these child jockeys are toddlers. They average around 2 to 4 years of age. And they are not only the jockeys for these camels, and they're the jockeys because not only they weigh very little, but because they start screaming and it scares the camel to death, and so the camel takes off as if its humps were on fire. Now, it's been reported that thousands of the children who are used as camel jockeys are actually trafficked from countries such as Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Iran, and Pakistan, as well as the Sudan, all lovely Islamic hellholes, expressly for the use as jockeys in the Persian Gulf states. So the rich Persian Gulf states, and that would be Saudi Arabia, for example, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, they are kidnapping children in other Islamic countries to tie to camels' humps so that they scream and the camels dart off. Estimates range between 5 and 40,000 of these child camel jockeys in the Persian Gulf. Now, many child camel jockeys, of course, are seriously injured, falling off the camels. Many die. The child jockeys lives in camps called Oshba, near the racetracks, and many are victims of abuse. Hundreds of children have been rescued from camel farms in Oman and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and taken back to their original homes Many, however, are obviously unable to identify their parents or their home communities. They don't even know if where they have come from, and many have come from South Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, or the Sudan. Now, some countries have issued penalties for trafficking, and just some. There's one or two countries that have actually issued penalties for trafficking in child camel jockeys. And very few have ordered the children who have been kidnapped to be returned to their homes. Now, there's a reason for that. And that is that in many instances, what those who are concerned about these children have found is that in many cases, the children were not kidnapped. No, their own parents sold them. They exchanged them for money. And if they are returned, the children would again be sold for the same purpose. Isn't that amazing? I mean, this is an Islamic problem. This is something that Muslims find great pleasure in. It's something that takes place in most Islamic countries, where children are bought from their parents or kidnapped from their parents as young as 2 years old, kept in camps, abused in those camps, and then tied to the backs of camels. And that's considered fun. Reminds me of Afghanistan. The reason that so many Americans who have gone to Afghanistan are so disgusted by our presence there, because they know that the two favorite games, and maybe there's three, that are routinely perpetrated by the Muslims is bocce ball, where the cutest little boy is sodomized by Afghanis, raped by them, where dogs are routinely tortured just for the fun of it, and why the third being that women are abused because they can. It's a sick culture with sick consequences. We'll be back in a minute.